Flexibility is great. That's why there's yoga. Flexibility for your insurance coverage is great too. That's why there's United Healthcare Insurance Plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, United Healthcare Insurance Plans offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage for medical, vision, dental, and more. One of these plans may be right for you if you're, say, between jobs, coming off your parents' plan, turning a side hustle into a full hustle, or even missed open enrollment. Want more flexibility? Find out more about United Healthcare Insurance Plans at uh1.com.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/news ad free. That's amazon.com/news ad free to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hello and welcome to the New Statesman podcast. I'm Deputy Editor Helen Lewis, and this week I'll be talking to George Eaton and Anoush Shakalian about the hangover from conference season and two upcoming by-elections. Then I talk to Elizabeth Minkle and Ian Steadman about two sides of online communities, fandom and trolling. Then finally, our literary editor Tom Gatty talks to Damien Barr about macho masculinity and Grayson Perry's guest edit. Finally, it's over. Conference season 2014 is at a close, with Nick Clegg's speech finishing the Lib Dem conference. We're now all set for two by-elections, one in Heywood and Middleton, which looks to be a comfortable Labour hold, and one in Clacton, where UKIP's looks set to take their first MP seat. I'm joined by our political editor, George Eaton, and editor of The Staggers, Anoush Shakalian, to talk about, well, what's been a pretty seismic month in politics, starting off with the Scottish referendum. George, how has conference season shaped the political landscape?
Well, I think the biggest winners were UKIP. Over that period, they claimed two MPs from the Conservatives, which no one saw coming. There'd been rumours of defections before, but most people thought the Conservatives would manage to keep the family together. Second, I'd say, were the Conservatives, who bounced back surprisingly well from the reckless defection. David Cameron made what is rightly regarded as the best, the strongest of the conference speeches, and fired his activists really with the belief that they can win. They've now got what they think is an attractive offer in terms of tax cuts, one that responds to Labour's cost of living attack. Then the Lib Dems probably give them the bronze medal. They in better spirits than a party some days on 6% in the polls deserves to be. And then the wooden spoon obviously goes to Labour, who didn't resemble anything like an opposition, sort of confidently marching towards government. Ed Miliband now notoriously forgot several key passages in his speech, and that has dogged them ever since.
It's astonishing that how people pick up the prevailing mood, and that therefore reflects how all your actions are seen. Because realistically, I mean, we talked about this before, Ed Miliband didn't have to memorise that speech. It was a party trick that no one asked for. And therefore, it just does seem like a terrible kind of unforced error. But equally well, we also see from this conference season how a good speech can really get you out of a hole, because the Tory party conference started so badly with Brooks, Newmark's paisley pyjamas and that defection to UKIP. But that speech that Cameron made reminded everybody, and you can see now, I think, why he's so far ahead on the who can you see as a prime minister, because that was a very prime ministerial speech. It was forward-looking, it was optimistic, it was uniting. Anoush, though, is there any crumb of consolation for Labour as they come out of conference season?
Yes, after conference season, what people always say after the sort of furore of the leaders' speeches is that there's always a poll bounce for each party after their conference season, which then goes back down again. So the Tory poll lead at the moment will probably go back down again. But however, for Labour, they didn't actually have that bounce, so that's a bit worrying for them. Although there are a lot of whisperings among MPs and sort of some senior figures, people like John Prescott, sort of expressing their disappointment in Ed Miliband's leadership. They're not going to get rid of him now, because they still have a chance of winning, and they would have no chance if they suddenly ousted their leader.
But George, it puts Labour in an interesting position, doesn't it? Because you can see why the Conservatives have to play such a defensive strategy, because they are bleeding away support to a party which is looking increasingly viable electorally. that's not happening with Labour. So what is the thinking behind the, you know, I know that the people have been talking about the fact that they're not even trying to contest Rochester and Stroud. They don't. They see that very much as a UKIP Conservative battle. Why are they playing the game this way?
Well, they feel they do have limited resources. They know they're going to be massively outspent by the Conservatives. And they really want to focus on their 106 target seats. And quite, they'll put it quite coldly and rationally that we'd love to be in a position to win it, but we're not. So therefore, there is no point in sort of pouring resources into the seat in the hope of finishing a close second, perhaps. Or it's just not a priority. But you're right on the Conservatives having put a lot out, a lot of policy out. And that's one of the things that gives Labour strategists comfort, that they feel, one told me the other day, Conservatives have used quite a lot of their pre-election material. We've held quite a lot back. They had to do that because David Cameron was on the rack after the UKIP defections, and they had to do something to move the polls. So they still feel they've got quite a lot of cards left to play, and that the Tories have used up quite a lot of their ammo.
And also it does show a slightly different way that the press reacts to Labour and Tory announcements. You know, the Tories have this advantage of being so ahead on you're trusted with the economy that David Cameron can make big pledges like we saw in his speech about moving the 40% rate of tax, moving up the minimum tax ban, and he doesn't immediately face that, and how are you going to pay for it? And how are you going to pay for it? Aren't you just turning on the money tap? Isn't that right, Anoush? I mean, he gets a different reaction to how Ed Miliband making those promises would have got.
Yeah, I mean, imagine if Labour had announced such things, they would have got absolutely pilloried by the Tories and by the press as well. So that is difficult for Labour. But I still think that their promise on the NHS rings much truer than what both the Tories and actually the Lib Dems have announced this conference season, because they're still the party that's most trusted with the NHS. And I don't see that changing in the polls anytime soon. So I actually think there was probably more substance and more that rang true in what Ed Miliband announced.
And to talk about the Lib Dems, we'd come back to this theme over and over again in the course of this parliament, is that they are extremely chipper, aren't they? And as you say, much more chipper than a party on 6%. Some, you know, came behind the Greens in the European elections. Is that because, George, they're making a calculation that they will once again hold the balance of power?
That's one of the reasons, certainly. And after this conference season, a hung parliament is looking more likely than ever. And that means they'll be potentially in a strong position to form another coalition, or at least to get some concessions in return for propping up a minority government. I think there are two other reasons why they're in a better mood than people would expect. The first is that although their national poll rating is terrible, so on a good day they compete with UKIP for third place, on a bad day they're fighting with the Greens for fourth, they're confident that they'll be able to hold on to quite a lot of their 56 MPs, especially those who are in Conservative-facing seats, where they can still try and win tactical votes from left-leaning voters, and also win over what strategists call sort of soft Tory voters, those who voted for David Cameron in 2010 because they thought he was a different kind of Conservative leader. He was modern, he was compassionate, and who've been alienated by the return of what Lib Dem says, the return of the nasty party. And then I also think it's because Tim Farron put it quite well. He said that we're a family. And you do feel that at a Lib Dem conference more than the much larger Conservative and
I do think there's a certain kind of Millwall, kind of everybody hates us and we don't care kind of spirit.
Absolutely. And there's a feeling things can only get better. And it's striking that although you've had now two Conservative defectors, no one's defected from the Lib Dems to Labour, say, and no one expects anyone to.
Because there was a lot of talk one time about Jeremy Brown and David Laws, who are two of the more sort of right-wing Lib Dems, but they do feel that tribal loyalty that people perhaps haven't given them credit for.
That's it, and almost their tribalism in some ways paradoxically comes from their lack of tribalism, that they think we are better than the Conservatives and Labour, who are just focused on ruthlessly on securing power, and we do care about things that most other parties don't want to talk about: the environment, civil liberties, mental health, obviously, which they've made a big issue. And to that extent, you can argue that the Lib Dems are still performing a valuable role as the third party, or maybe not the third party now, but in pushing often marginalised issues up the agenda.
And let's talk a minute about the smaller parties, at least in Westminster terms. So we saw the background to a lot of the Scottish referendum campaign was anti-Toryism. It was, you know, you don't want to be ruled by the Tories. Is there going to be a bounce? We know SNP membership has gone up. Could SNP be looking at taking Westminster seats off Labour?
Yes, I think the likelihood is that they will take a couple now. Probably not more than that, because I think they are riding a bit of a post-referendum wave, and there'll be a swing back to Labour once the question is really framed as, well, do you want a Labour government or a Tory government? But they'll be able to, they'll obviously benefit from this huge activist base, and they'll also be able to say to Scottish voters, look, give us more people at Westminster, because we need to hold the government's feet to the fire on further devolution.
And what about the Greens, Anoush? Because, I mean, Brighton Pavilion is an interesting seat. The Green council has run into problems there. I mean, we always have this conversation about, and I know our readers are very, very strongly kind of say, well, you know, you give a lot of coverage to UKIP and not to the Greens. Do the Greens deserve more attention?
I think, actually, yes, they do, because they have got a chance, well, a slim chance of winning Holborn and St Pancras as well. But apparently this is a problem for the Greens, because they actually divide their resources then, throwing them at this London seat rather than Brighton Pavilion again. And so this is actually, I've heard from a source in the Green Party, that there's a bit of bad blood between the leader, Natalie Bennett, and those who are fighting to keep the Brighton seat as well. So there is a bit of a power struggle there that's worth looking at. And they do deserve a bit more attention, I think.
Because I think they could certainly build up their base at a European level, which is something that, you know, again, it's what UKIP did, and it's a way that UKIP managed to fund itself in its slightly less glory-filled Doncaster races, standing on a tank days. But, well, that all sounds very interesting. We'll come back to this after the by-election, and we'll also look at the upcoming by-election in Rochester and Strood next week, which looks set to be a rather closer race than the two that are reporting tonight. Thank you, George and Anoush. When online communities are good, they can be very, very good. They can crowdfund important projects. But when they're bad, they can be very bad indeed. So I'm joined by Elizabeth Minkle, who writes for us on fandom, and Ian Steadman, our science writer, to discuss the two sides of the coin of online communities. Ian, let's talk about trolling first. There's been a very sad case, it's been in the news recently, of Brenda Leyland, a woman who was accused by Sky of being somebody who sent messages about McCanns on social media. We know that there have been a huge amount of conspiracy theories about the McCann case. It's not entirely clear to what extent Brenda Leyland was involved or to what extent this contributed to her suicide. Obviously, you have to be very careful about attributing particular events to causing suicides. But it does shed a light on the fact that there are a lot of people, and it comes up again and again when you look at this case and other cases, and people don't believe that they are the kind of person who would have sent these messages on the internet. Are people getting nastier, or is the internet creating a space for people to be nasty in a way that they weren't before?
I'd say the latter. But everything I say in this conversation is going to be, like, we have to bear in mind that my perspective on this is very different to yours. So I can write about a controversial subject on the internet. I don't get any kind of trouble for that. People don't call me names or abuse me or send me or call me up or anything like that. Whereas much less controversial things can be written about by women and minorities, and they get a whole truckload of problems about it.
I have to say that writing about Gamergate, so luckily most of our listeners, I'm sure, have no idea, living in blissful ignorance of this idea, which is a strange, huge web of conspiracies that came out. It's eventually mutated into this idea that, depending on who you believe, you know, women are coming to ruin computer games. And I said, well, I wrote a piece for The Telegraph, which was already slightly trolling myself, I guess, saying in some ways, yeah, women are coming to invade computer games. Yeah, they're playing them in record numbers, that computer games will turn away from macho power fantasies. And it was astonishing. I mean, it was 72 hours of people bombarding me. And actually, it wasn't, and this was on Twitter, it wasn't all just kind of, you know, hateful, blah, blah, blah. Although there was a fair bit of that. There was just lots of people sort of trying to sap my will to live by getting into endless arguments about facts that I hadn't seen and things that were impossible to stand up one way or the other. But that, I mean, that kind of tips over into conspiracy theory, doesn't it?
Yeah, there's a lot of blurring of boundaries here. It's interesting because you've just used the two different definitions of trolling in the same sentence when talking about the same thing, which kind of, there aren't two real definitions. Trolling used to mean basically being a wind-up merchant. So you'd be on a message board and someone would be talking about something and you'd say something stupid just to get a reaction. And that's what a lot of people still think of as being trolling. But trolling has also now come to mean essentially digital harassment. Mm-hmm. And as much as we might like to think there's a boundary, a binary there, they actually kind of bleed into each other. There's a point at which trying to wind someone else up becomes abusing them, becomes harassing them, becomes something much worse.
Well, it's much like the argument that we have about things like, you know, Ricky Gervais and ironic racism or ironic disablism and stuff like that. And it comes to the point where you're saying, you know, if you are saying the word Hmong ironically, that your intention might be ironic, but at the end of the day, you are still saying a word that many people find offensive and hurtful.
Intentions aren't magic.
Yeah, and I've had shouted at them in the street. And I think the same thing happens with a lot of trolling cases. You know, you might say that you're just doing it to wind people up, but if, it's about the effect on the end person. I don't know, do you get trolled, Elizabeth?
I don't. I don't think I'm well known enough to do that, to warrant that.
But okay, well, let's talk about the nicer side of kind of the way the internet has allowed vast numbers of people to coalesce around a particular interest. I mean, we've heard about it in relation to trolling, and I think there is a lot of organised trolling. But equally, the flip side of that is people coming together around things that they love and fandom. So tell us a bit about the fandoms that you spend time in.
Well, I've been in a lot of fandoms over the years. Currently in the Sherlock fandom, which I don't like to talk about with people outside of Sherlock because it makes me a little upset.
Are you in the Elementary fandom?
No. I've only seen a few episodes, though I'm not anti-Elementary. I don't like that divide.
It speaks for certain. Is there a war that I don't know about going on?
I see a lot of Sherlock hate from the Elementary fandom, but I think it's all self-selection, what you see coming across your dash, obviously. But, you know, I've been in online fandoms since the late 90s. Practiced fanish things before that, but I didn't really have a way to connect people. And I think, you know, that's why you see so much of it recently. I think it's just been building and building over the last decade or so.
For people who totally don't understand this, yeah. What counts as kind of fanish activity? I mean, I classically think about things like fan fiction communities, you know, writing stories yourself that continue the series or the book that you love. What else does it comprise?
I think that the classic thing people would think of when they think of a fan or, you know, a nerd, sci-fi nerd would be this kind of fact-based fandom, you know, the Star Wars people with memorizing every fact in the expanded universe and getting really upset when it's Jost.
Jost being a word, right? So this is kind of named after Joss Whedon. Did he do it deliberately? Did he used to wind up the fans by just, like, they would get a certain theory about a couple were going to get together and then he would just kill it stone dead in the next series?
I mean, I guess only he can tell us for sure. I mean, he was a participant in the official message boards or the kind of sanctioned spaces. So were the other writers too. And, you know, it was a very early example of where these lines were getting very blurry.
So this is for Buffy the Vampire Slayer.
Yeah, this is back in, you know, around the turn of the millennium. And they would, you know, the writers would be in there and they'd say, hey, we're the writers. What do you think of the episode? And, you know, obviously they're in a really tricky position because they can't listen too much. I think that, you know, I think... Oh, there are a lot of screenwriters who do think that, yeah, ruining your theories and killing characters for the hell of it creates dramatic tension. I give him more credit than others on that front.
I think George R. R. Martin is a particular fan of, like, going, ha-ha, I have the keys to all your dreams here in my pocket, and, you know, who will I kill next?
You know that quote that he had about the last book is just going to be, like, 1,000 pages of snow or something like that, you know, just like an empty field.
Ian, have you ever written fan fiction?
Yeah, I have, actually.
Oh, really?
I remembered this the other day, so I was thinking about how silly it all is, and then I remember that, actually, when I was a kid, I wrote some Legend of Zelda fan fiction.
That's really good.
I was 10 or so, but me and a friend got really into, like, coming up with this big story about, like, We used to like designing video games, but like using cartoons on paper and then coming up with storylines for them. So yeah, I've effectively come up with Legend of Zelda fan fiction, which is probably in my parents' loft somewhere.
I wrote Harry Potter fan fiction.
Me too.
Yeah. Yeah, which unfortunately is now lost in the like mists of GeoCities or something, and hopefully we'll never be found again. And Laurie Penny confessed that she'd been a fan fiction writer. I think lots of people who like writing like it because it's kind of it's a training ground. You don't have to do all the work yourself, but you can start in medias res. You know, you've got the characters, you've got the setup, everything's there, and you can just actually write, and you don't have to do that really boring kind of groundwork and research and everything. Another one fandom that I find really fascinating is Supernatural. So that, I mean, very few people over here have watched that. Can you tell us a bit about that?
Supernatural is kind of, I would say, the uber fandom amongst media fandoms right now. I guess it's, I think it's in its 10th season. I've actually never watched it. You know,
I'm almost scared to watch it because people like it so much.
And it's just, it's got a really complicated, you know, I wrote a piece for you guys a few months ago about the fan creator relations and, just it's really just seems to be, I'm not sure what the ratings are like beyond, they get pretty large ratings that seem to be just the fans, you know. It's not a general interest show, which, like Sherlock, when you and I talk about, like, who's watching it and what fans think versus the public or whatever.
A lot can happen in 3 years, like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage that lasts nearly 3 years in some states. Learn more at uh1.com.
But, you know, it brings up a lot of complicated issues. You know, the fandom is very, very powerful. They raise a ton of money for charity. They have constantly, they seem to have fan conventions, you know, where the actors are there and they raise a ton of money. They charge a ton of money for those.
But I think Supernatural raises this question because there's an awful lot of shipping, this is idea of writing relationships between people and around the main characters. And it's something that obviously looms very large in the writers' minds while they're writing it, that they have this kind of huge unofficial kind of writing staff that are doing their own things on the side. Now, I know this will make you very uneasy, but wasn't that one of the problems of the last series of Sherlock?
You want to fight right now?
Yeah, I think we want to fight right now. Because
you threatened to beat me up over this as well.
I told you I wasn't going to discuss it with you. I think the difference is, in my opinion, having not seen Supernatural, but having read a lot about it, I know the writers there are hyper aware of their fan base, and it's hard for me to articulate exactly why it's different, you know, but they've had whole episodes that are just kind of through the looking glass, like they're all playing fictional versions of the actors, you know, and it's the sort of thing where
they've gone really seriously meta.
Yes. Yes. That's the word I was looking for. Sherlock, you know, I definitely think that, The Empty Hearse, the first episode of the last series was, you know, obviously it was a meta commentary.
Mm.
I think as a single episode that, yeah, obviously it was looking at the fans. It was also looking at the British public or the worldwide public who's viewing it or the British public who consumed, you know, the return of Sherlock Holmes more than a century ago. Because obviously that was the ultimate fan creator relationship where they just demanded this guy come back. You know, but there were a lot of elements that people threw the accusation of fan service at, which I don't agree with. I think that if they're servicing anyone, it's definitely themselves. They're very self-indulgent writers.
They might stop sniggering at the back end.
You know, and I think it's interesting too that I just think the accusation of fan service more broadly implies that someone else has more of a cultural privilege than you. Someone else is a fan. They've invested more time. They've invested more money. Whatever, for whatever reason, they identify as a fan, and maybe you do not. Maybe you are a casual viewer, and so. When you say fan service, you're suggesting that this person in a position of privilege is being serviced in a way that you are not. I just think that's a really tricky setup because that assumes a lot about the other person that you assume is being serviced.
So this is the idea that, you know, it becomes almost impossible for somebody who just tunes in because they've just happened to watch the news beforehand to understand what's going on because it's so full of illusions and in-jokes and
right. And I think there's a lot of, and I don't, I see this in when people talk about Doctor Who too, it's just, there are a lot of assumptions that you're missing something if you just casually turn, and I do think it's a mistake for them to have such complicated episodes as a Christmas special because, you know, that's the time when I think you're supposed to just, as far as I gather, being here amongst British people, you just sit down and watch it on Christmas, you know, without all the plot. I think those episodes were needlessly internally complicated, but perhaps didn't rely on you to have seen every single episode multiple times and, you know.
No, I think it's really interesting because what you talk about there about this idea of kind of uber fans and that kind of that fan hierarchy is also something that you see very much in organized troll communities. So Anita Sarkeesian, who's a video game blogger who was targeted quite a lot, has talked about this kind of idea of gamification of misogyny. So the idea that there are kind of unofficial leaderboards that people push themselves further and further. And I think that applies to fan communities and troll communities as well, that people do it for kudos within the, you know, there is definitely a hierarchy in these online communities that can drive people to really extreme behavior. And that's when you start seeing weird stuff happening. Ian, just to come back to the point about trolls, I mean, do you think that there is a legislative solution to this, or is it a social solution?
My gut instinct is that this is, because it isn't something new, it is just people using a new format and medium in a way to do something they could have always done, but just do it more easily and more quickly. I don't know.
Can I ask a question?
Go for it.
I'm not sure I would wholly agree with you when you say it's the medium rather. People's behavior hasn't changed. Mm. Well, people's behavior has changed, but, you know. I don't know. You're a science writer. Have you encountered any of these studies they're doing on empathy and how it kind of drops when you are talking to someone, a digital avatar? Mm. You know, I can't see you. I can't imagine you.
That's a pretty well-established fact. It's called de-individuation, and the idea being that computer-mediated communication is because you can't get the facial signals, even just the extent of your eye contact. You can't read people's expression. It provides that form of that you also see in people who just cannot read. You know, they can't see what they're doing to people. But I also think there's a thing about the idea that a lot of these cases happen. So there's we always talk about this. There are different types of trolling. So there are essentially like neighbor disputes that now get, so instead of people having a row over their hedge, they now, you know, have a row over Facebook and start sort of spreading mean messages about each other. That's one thing. And then there's the kind of group on high profile target attack, which is again a different thing. And that, I think, you see a type of behavior that you also see around the way that kind of newspapers cover celebrities, where there is a de-individuation and dehumanization because people wouldn't ever feel you could say that to a real person, but you're not a real person, you know, it's someone off the telly. And
dehumanization is an incredibly old thing. It goes back to like very old forms of racism and things like that. I mean,
But prior to the development of the web, how often would you talk to a stranger at a distance?
I think that a drop in empathy is there, but it's also, it's just a different kind of dehumanization is what it seems like to me. And it seems like, again, it's just a faster, more repeatable version of something which already could exist or did exist. But it's just more obvious now because it's harder to ignore.
And the potential disruption that one person can cause is now so much greater. Mm. I mean, that's the thing. If you've got 150 friends, then the chances that one of them might say something out of line on a particular day. But you know, the multiplier effect of that now is that one person can be so much more disruptive. Anyway, we should definitely, let's come back to this and we'll tease you more about Sherlock. Sorry, Elizabeth. And thank you, Ian.
I'm Tom Gatti, culture editor of The New Statesman, and I'm on the line with the writer Damien Barr, who has written a wonderful contribution to our Grayson Perry guest edit issue about sexuality and the great white male. Now, Damien, when we first asked you to contribute to this issue, did you know exactly what you wanted to say from the off?
No, it was really when I started kind of exploring contemporary ideas of masculinity that it became clear, you know, what I wanted to write about. I knew I wanted to write about homophobia in some way, shape or form, but it's become so much more sophisticated and internalized. And so what I realized I was going to write about was the straight acting gay man and the kind of tyranny of that culture.
You start with a sort of very blunt and kind of old fashioned instance of homophobia, don't you? Quite a frightening one.
Yeah, I mean, I live in Brighton, which people think is a kind of Wizard of Oz gay bubble. And it is on Pride Day, but you know, for every other day of the year, it's much like other places. And since I've lived there, I've been chased or attacked several times by groups of homophobic men, never women, but that's not to say that doesn't happen. It just hasn't happened to me. And so I describe a scene where I am walking home from the train station late at night and I get chased by a gang who have knives and who chase me back to my house, back to my front door, and I only just get in the front door in time. And I talk about what it was like, you know, that happening, and also then just, you know, going to work the next day and people being sympathetic about it, but saying, "Why would they attack you? You don't look that gay." And so as if you know, the gayer you look, the more justified homophobia is. And it really kind of troubled me that I felt offended and aggrieved when they were actually trying to be nice. And so that's what I wanted to explore in my piece.
It seems to me there's a part towards the end of the piece. There's a sentence where you say, over centuries, where you're talking about the straight man, the great white
yes.
male, the straight man. Over centuries, all his careful nurturing has been naturalized. He is the norm,
yes.
but he is not natural.
Yes.
And that idea of being the norm but not natural seemed to me central, not only to your piece, but to the whole issue and to Grayson Perry's argument in his essay. So how different are those two things, norm and natural, and how have they come to be so confused and elided?
Well, I think that traditional masculinity is not natural. It is a learned behaviour. I remember growing up and my dad saying, stand up straight, lift your feet when you walk, sending me to boxing classes and all of these things to make a man out of me. You make a man. A man is not born. A male child is born, and he is turned by a culture into a kind of man. And I wanted to just make the point very clearly that masculinity is a learned behaviour. The great white male is a construct. And once we accept that's constructed, we take away a lot of the power from it. It is not natural. It is completely artificial, and therefore is not privileged any more than any other kind of masculinity or behaviour.
And I suppose if you look back through history, the ideas of masculinity vary hugely from period to period.
Yeah.
And in some periods yeah. were very effete or very un-heterosexual, very, very homosexual.
Yeah. Yeah, I think if you transported, most men back to sort of, the Elizabethan court or certain French courts, they would find that sexuality was much more fluid, and also the way that men dressed was much more akin to the way that women were dressed, bejeweled, fancy. We're talking about a certain class of men, of course. But I think that those standards of masculinity vary over time and across cultures, and they continue to do so now. What's interesting is when people transgress that, when men transgress that, the dominant masculinity still punishes other kinds of masculinity that, that either compete or contradict what it is that they're saying. So the power lies with the dominant form, with the great white man that Grayson writes about so brilliantly in his essay.
It is quite interesting that you say that you find at the moment gay culture particularly intolerant of campness. Is that something that is particularly noticeable now, at this moment now in 2014?
I think that it is. There are various, gay culture is very fragmented and diverse, and the closer we get to some kind of equality, in some ways, that this argument is a luxury. But you get, if you look online, the idea of a straight acting gay man, the mask, musk, dude, this idea that we have to, I don't know if it's a leftover residue of having to fit in or wanting to be seen to be the same as everybody else, to be in order to be treated the same. I don't know, but I do think that there is a kind of intolerance, certainly in the sexual aesthetic, and I talk about, I talk about that in my piece. I think the more interactions move online, the easier it is to silence people or shut people out who you think are camp or whose masculinity isn't, they just aren't butch enough for you, basically. So I do think that there's a reaction against that. Maybe part of it, in some sense, is healthy. The idea that all gay men had to be sort of mincing and simpering Larry Grayson type people sure. in order to be very identifiably so, in order to be laughed at and contained with humour and completely desexualized, is a problem that we, I think, have largely moved beyond as a culture, although there are still those tropes and those stereotypes. So, but I do think that, the rise of the straight acting gay man is problematic, because it's, I think, about internalized homophobia. There are as many ways to be gay as there are to be straight. And you don't have to ape your oppressor in order to have power or status or freedom.
You talk about the twin forces of homophobia and misogyny, and
yes.
How do you think those have changed over the past 10 years? Is it that the situation has become better, or is it that it's less overt but still pretty endemic?
I think legislatively it certainly has got better, but I think, you know, in terms of our culture, you know, I'm continually shocked by the casual misogyny. Everyday sexism is a, you know, terrifyingly good example of, you know, the stuff that women have to put up with every day. And certainly as a gay man, you know, I feel like, you know, the many microaggressions of homophobia, you know, are still kind of inflicted on me. I may be better at managing them, maybe fewer of them, but they definitely still happen. But I think that it's become more sophisticated. I think the straight acting gay man is about internalized homophobia. I definitely think that. I do feel that. But so back to your question, has it got better or worse in the last 10 years? Again, I think it's partly dependent on class and race, and, you know, if you're just dealing with one variable, if you're talking about intersectionality. But I always think of Judith Butler and the idea of gender crimes. You know, effete gay men, camp gay men, and women who are ballsy are refusing in both instances to perform their gender properly, and that's a gender crime, and we continue to be punished for that. And we see that in popular culture, and we see that in our politics, and you know, we see it all around us every day.
Something that more broadly Grayson identifies in his essay, and you hinted it in yours, is this idea that the straight white male is a sort of default position, and it's very, very hard to talk about because it's become the norm, it's become the standard, and it's become the way of looking at the world, which makes it very hard for the world to look back on it.
Yes.
Do you agree with that line? And if so, how do we go about dismantling that? Or is it already in the process of being dismantled, and just with a bit more time, it will crumble to the ground?
Well, no, I think that there is always going to be a move in any culture for one group to be dominant, and to protect, you know, to self-protect and protect its rights and its privilege. There, I finally used the word privilege. But, you know, I think the very first thing to do is to point out that it is not natural, that it is a construct, and that if we construct it in one way, we can choose to construct it in another way, thinking optimistically. And also, you know, let's say that, you know, the system operates to oppress those men as well. There's a great project called the Good Men Organization, which is about, you know, offering men different ways to be, you know, straight white men. You know, to not be a part of that system, to share their privilege, to, you know, behave in different ways. You know, I think that culture operates to oppress the oppressor as well, as well as those who, you know, who do obviously enjoy the privilege. But I think the first step is just to kind of recognise that it is a construct, and therefore we can choose to construct it differently. It's just Lego, you know.
Which is, of course, now much more gendered than it was in my childhood.
Oh, God. I saw the other day some adverts for Kinder Egg, and it was pink Kinder Egg for girls and blue Kinder Egg for boys, and I just kind of wanted to puke, you know. But, you know, look at, you know, brilliant Katie Guest, the literary editor of The Independent on Sunday, who said that she won't review books aimed for children's books, which are, you know, gendered children's books aimed at girls or aimed at boys. And I just think that that's a really bold, brave, you know, step for a national newspaper to be taken.
Absolutely.
Because that nexus of gender and sexuality is very complicated, but it is also kind of, if you find yourself at it, it's quite clear.
And it does begin in childhood, that sort of imprinting begins very, very early on.
Yeah, yeah. And it becomes this cliche of nature and nurture, but, you know, if we pan back from that and we realise that nature is really only what we nurture most and are most invested in, then it's all up for grabs.
Damien Barr, thank you very much for talking to us.
My pleasure. Thank you.
You've been listening to the New Statesman podcast. You can find us every week on iTunes or at newstatesman.com/podcast. Our theme tune is Devil with the Devil by the Underscore Orchestra, licensed under Creative Commons, and our producer is Philip Moore.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/news ad free. That's amazon.com/news ad free to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hello, Freddie here. I want to tell you about a new way you can support the New Statesman's independent journalism. Every morning I send out Morning Call, our daily newsletter covering everything you need to know about British politics. It's free to sign up, plus for just £3 a month, you'll get a recommended daily piece of ours sent to you in full, plus exclusive polling analysis from Ben Walker, a weekly update from Will Dunn, and our featured piece on Sundays. If you enjoy this podcast, you'll love Morning Call. Head to morningcall.substack.com and subscribe now.